This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Republican tax plan includes a new tax on college endowments. Illinois Wesleyan University President Eric Jensen calls that unfair, saying higher ed does not just sit on its money.
If it's not all spent on student assistance, it may be spent on faculty or staff positions. It may be spent on general operating expenses for facilities and so forth, all consistent with the mission.
Jensen tells GLT's Charlie Schlenker such a tax would drive up the cost of college for students and their families. You'll hear from NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne about covering flyover country during the Trump administration. He was in Bloomington-Normal for GLT's Radio Faces. And it's a one-on-one with 13th District Democratic congressional candidate Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. IPR's Brian Moline has the interview. All of that and a GLT news update on the way. It's November 13th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Colleges and universities are raising concerns about provisions in the House Republican tax overhaul. They say those changes will increase the cost of college for many students and their families while also cutting into endowments at private schools. The plan would impose a 1.4% excise tax on college endowments at private universities, at which the endowment is more than $100,000 per student. That's a small percentage on a big number. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Illinois Wesleyan University President Eric Jensen about higher ed concerns.
Well, first off, I think this bill's in flux. My understanding is that the new, today's version or yesterday's version of H.R. 1 had upped that limit to $250,000 per student. To put that in perspective, $100,000 per student means that we're going to draw roughly 5% in income off of that. I'm going to use that for scholarships. So $100,000 in endowment generates $5,000 in scholarships per student. That's not exactly consistent with the picture of these wealthy institutions that are sitting on their resources. It's true. We're financially very secure. We have an endowment that's over $200 million. But when you actually think about how that's used, at $5,000 per student, it's hardly excessive. We give something like $25,000 in average scholarships per student per year. And so this endowment that apparently is big enough to be taxed is in fact generating something like a fifth of the total support that we give to our students. Our net tuition on average for an entering student last year was about $21,000, even though our stated tuition was $46,000. So there's a picture of elite, unaffordable institutions that are hoarding their resources. In our case, nothing could be farther from the truth.
So where is a healthy limit, then, for that sort of calculation? What qualifies as super wealthy that should be taxed, and where is the cutoff for people who are comfortable but really not doing much more than getting by?
Well, I think it's bigger than you might think. Think about a place like Grinnell. Grinnell has a famously big endowment for a place that's not much bigger than us because they had Warren Buffett, in large part because they had Warren Buffett managing their portfolio, and he appears to be pretty good at what he does.
Sweet.
Yeah. So they've got more than $2 billion. We've got more than $200 million, and they've got a student body that's roughly the same size. And so that means that instead of $5,000 per student, if they chose to use it all for scholarships, they could use it at $50,000 per student. What that lets them do is open the door very wide to students that have very little ability to pay. They can offer students essentially full scholarships and bear it out of that endowment and have a little bit left over for some of the things that they need to use an endowment for. So even a big-sounding endowment like $2 billion isn't really that big if it's put to use in service of students. And then, well, is $10 billion big? Is $60 billion or whatever the Harvard number, is that a big number? number? Yes. And in fact, there's even some evidence that some schools have been using offshore, that the Paradise Papers are showing that some schools are using offshore tax havens as a way of sheltering some of these very large reserves. I think the question is more about purpose than amount. And if it's really about hoarding endowments for endowment's sake, I think we may have an issue.
So per student is not really the right way to look at it. You have to look at other uses for this.
I think per student is a reasonable metric, but I think that the number that you might think of as fairly large. If I were to say to the average person on the street that Illinois Wesleyan would qualify at this $100,000 in endowment per student, one might think that that's a mark of a wealthy institution. Now, let's be clear, we are fortunate to be financially secure, but the amount of income that's actually thrown off by that to be able to use on behalf of students is much, much smaller than people think. It's kind of like an endowment is a little bit like a savings account because you want to have a fund for a rainy day, but you don't want to draw on it if you don't have to. An endowment is a little bit like a pension account, although pension accounts you usually draw more than you would off an endowment because
you expect to exhaust them.
Yeah, you expect to exhaust
by the time you kick the bucket.
And so we draw much less than that than would typically be the case when it comes time to start drawing on a pension, because we want to preserve that principle forever. But we do want to draw on the earnings and use it for the things that we need to use. It's a little bit like you hear about student debt, or you hear about students who go to school and don't graduate, and somehow that brush is used to tar an entire industry. And you know the truth. If you're thinking about student debt, something like 10% of the kids coming out of high school go to for-profit institutions. Something like 20% of all the loans go to those kids, and something like 40% of all the defaults come from those kids. They also are highly unlikely actually to graduate, and the whole point of going to school is to get that credential. So we're not like that. Illinois State's not like that. You know, there are a number of institutions that are nothing like the institutions that are responsible for the kind of junk that's being thrown around regarding, you know, this allegedly homogeneous industry. Our students have a debt that is under $30,000. That's on average, and averages can sometimes mask outliers, but that's a low number. Our students get something like $800,000 more in expected lifetime income as a result of that investment. We have default rates that are vanishingly small, about 2%. We have 95-96% of our students either employed or in graduate school within 6 months of graduation. You know, we're not that place that you hear about, and I think by extension, we're also, when you talk about the fact that we've got a $200 million endowment, we're not that sort of large holding on to the endowment sort of place that you often hear of. We're fortunate to be financially secure.
I haven't heard you actually say what level would be appropriate to tax, though.
Oh, I don't know. I think it has to do more with. The conversation initially got started because there were a number of institutions who were characterized as simply holding on to their investment and letting it grow to the extent that they could let it grow. And the question, I think,
Princeton, Amherst.
Those folks. And the question is, I don't know about Amherst, Princeton. And the question is begged. Well, at what point does it grow sufficiently large that you've reinvested and now you begin to use it in ways that are beneficial to society? I mean, the education is fundamentally a good for society. We, by training people, by allowing them to realize their full potential, we're making an investment in them that then pays dividends to the whole society. And so the idea that we as a society ought to care about getting our students educated, getting them out there and being productive members of the workforce, and there are, therefore, I suppose, by extension, making sure that tax-advantaged endowments are put to good public use, like educating students, I think that's a more meaningful criteria than simply a dollar amount.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Eric Jensen, the president of Illinois Wesleyan University, about the implications of the tax bill on higher education. Let's frame it a different way. We mentioned Amherst, Grinnell, Princeton. They use their endowment for at least half their operating budget. How does Illinois Wesleyan stack up by that sort of measurement?
Well, our operating budget is probably six or seven, maybe more, times our normal endowment draw.
Not in the same league at all, then?
No, not at all. And I think most schools, if you talk to them, the schools with large endowments, I had a friend who was the president of an institution that had a little over $1 billion, they find ways to spend it. They commit it in ways that are consistent with their mission, but are nonetheless our obligations. And so if it's not all spent on student assistance, it may be spent on faculty or staff positions. It may be spent on general operating expenses for facilities and so forth, all consistent with the mission, but also obligated. So they rely on tuition revenue in the same way that we do.
Do you believe there ought to be regulation to encourage that sort of consideration or to mandate that sort of consideration above and beyond a certain level?
No, I think that colleges and universities are mission-driven places, that we understand why we're there. And I think even if you spoke to, I think I read that Princeton made nine figures maybe, off of the pharmaceutical patents that have been developed there. Those, though, are then turned around and reinvested in ways that allow them either to generate new knowledge or to educate current students. Sometimes it's hard to see where that line would even be drawn.
So nobody is really sitting on it, in your view?
No. The cynical view that I have is that much of the sort of provisions of H.R. 1, especially as they're aimed at education, are aimed at generating current revenue at the expense of investment. If, for example, you reduce the tax credit to parents for educating their students, well, fewer students are going to be educated than would otherwise be the case, and therefore the benefits to society that would have accrued down the road, the investment isn't going to happen. It's a very short-sighted way of generating revenue in the short run, and I think many of the provisions of H.R. 1 are like that.
Do you pay any taxes on your endowment's investment income as of today?
No, we're a tax exempt charity, and so and as I mentioned, our endowment is based on the donations of others to us, and to the extent that we have earned through investing the earnings from those gifts.
The bill would also force college employees to count tuition breaks they receive as income. They don't have to do that now. For those working on a PhD or with college-age kids, that's a recruiting tool for you, right?
It's a very good one. Yeah, we are not going to pay salaries that approximate our corporate competition in town. And so especially for those on the non-academic side, if we're competing for people in town, that's I speak to you now as someone who's had a couple of kids recently through school, and I know you're a little bit in that same situation.
Oh, yeah.
These are real dollars that are substantial hiring incentives. And, of course, for our faculty, there's two reasons that we like it. One, of course, is that this is our business. You know, we are educating students, and we want our own children to enjoy the sorts of advantages that we're conveying to others. And then, of course, it's a hiring advantage for us as well. We don't pay as much as a Research One school would pay for a host of reasons, but we do have this offsetting tuition benefit that helps. I went to an institution that didn't have that. I worked at an institution that didn't have that, and in hindsight, kind of looked longingly at that as a benefit that would have been wonderful to have received.
How much difference would you say that did make in the ability to recruit talent? Doing the A-B comparison.
Yeah, hard to say. I think part of it is that at small privates like us, it's more the norm. And so we would be at a competitive disadvantage if we didn't have it. And since we do, it's kind of hard to say just quantitatively how big the advantage is.
There are some other provisions in the tax bill that colleges and universities aren't crazy about, including the end of student loan interest deductions for those paying off their student debt. What do you think that will have as an effect long term if passed?
Again, it's all these are on the margin, disincentivizing the process of getting a higher education degree of some sort. I think that the bigger deductions are unfortunately concentrated amongst those who've wisely or not accumulated a great amount of debt at places like for-profits. And so I would guess that the impact is going to be different across different sectors of the broader higher ed landscape. But it can't be a good thing. You know, the notion in general that we're going to give up what could be useful investments for the sake of a little little bit of short-run revenue, and this is a little bit of short-run revenue. I find that troubling.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Eric Jensen is the president of Illinois Wesleyan University. He's in the studio with us. Let's pivot to enrollment. It's been a tough year for Illinois' public colleges and universities, with a few exceptions. Enrollment is down around the state, which is a net exporter of college students. How does Illinois Wesleyan's enrollment look this fall?
We're also down a little bit. It's a cyclical business. Some years you're up, some years you're down, and this is one where, as you've said, Illinois is a hard state. I think that there's a tendency to think of, as I've said before, higher education as sort of a homogeneous mass, and it's not. The truth is that most students who go to colleges go to public colleges and universities, and the public colleges and universities in Illinois have had a tough row to hoe for the last couple of years. We've been affected by things like MAP grants and the uncertainty surrounding them. About a quarter of our students receive MAP grants, and so we, early on, as this uncertainty, as this dysfunction between the governor and the legislature was coming to full fruition, made the decision that we were going to help our students cover whatever missing MAP funds may have eventuated. And that's nice, because the financially right thing to do and the morally right thing to do coincided exactly. So we were able to step up and help our students. But the students that we didn't have yet, the ones who were thinking about coming to Illinois and were debating as to whether or not there was going to be the Illinois state system that they knew of, or whether there was going to be the MAP grant at a private school, or generally what the climate of higher ed and education was like in Illinois, I think that hurt. You know, that hurt a number of institutions.
How long will it continue to hurt?
I think Illinois is actually rebounding. I think we have a budget in place. Miracle of miracles, and there can be some long-term planning that's done. I think another thing that actually hurt us was the international climate. There was a lot of harsh rhetoric, and I think many places saw fairly significant declines in their international recruiting. And whether that's going to bounce back or not, I can't say for certainty. I'm thrilled. Since the last time we spoke, we have a new vice president, a new position, vice president of enrollment and marketing, and a new person, Leanne Hughes, in that job with a number of new staff people. And so we're actively both being more aggressive within Illinois, getting across that message that, hey, we're not afflicted in the same way that many of these institutions are. And we're also looking outside Illinois in aggressive ways. We have somebody who's in St. Louis. We have somebody who's in Denver. And we're looking at somebody in Atlanta as a way of looking at other markets.
How much is the international cohort down? How much is the total enrollment down?
We're at a little under 1,700 this year, so we're down We're down a little bit more than we'd like to be in this instance. Our international enrollment fluctuates more than most enrollments year to year. We've had years where we've had 60 or 70 international students coming in. We've had years where we had 30, and this year was more like 30 coming in.
Okay. So is that the smallest headcount since 1988, or
we're at a relatively low level for us. I think that we could comfortably handle more students than are there right now. We have a choice. You know, what we're trying to do is create an environment that is special in a lot of ways. We want the really meaningful interaction between faculty and students, and between students themselves. And so we want to make sure that we're picking the kind of students who are going to benefit most from that environment, and we're going to benefit that environment the most. It's sort of a synergistic process. We're very happy with the incoming class. They are the test scores are just like they've always been, impressive. The high school grade point averages are impressive. We're also very diverse. We have significantly more students who self-identify as African American or Latino than in past years. And that's important, because what we do is train leaders. And the leaders in the world to come are going to be leading in a multinational, multi-ethnic, multiracial setting. And it's important that our world on campus look like that world that they're going to be the leaders of.
So if you're at 1,700 and you'd like to be at 2,000 or 2,200, What do you do? Do you have too many faculty for that number of students? And how do you adjust?
Well, I think we want to keep our eye on a long-run strategic goal. And as I said, it's a cyclical business. That we there are years that are up, there are years that are down. And the key thing is not to be hasty in any sort of response. I think that we want to grow. I think 2,200 is probably bigger than we'd like to be. But 1,900, 2,000, somewhere in there, that's a nice size. And so that means a reasoned, careful approach at growing enrollment to make sure that we continue to get the students that we want. One of the most interesting conversations I've had was at Heartland Community College. We're talking, our provost and vice president for enrollment and marketing and our registrar, we're talking to their counterparts at Heartland, with Rob Widmer and I being sort of either spectators or brokers, I'm not sure what, at this meeting, and talking about how we might ease the path into Illinois Wesleyan in ways that are appropriate for us and for the Heartland students, for Heartland students who are either 1 year in or have gotten their AA. We are really part of the fabric of this town. Bloomington, Normal, you know, Illinois Wesleyan, the number of people I meet as I come around to various functions who are alums, who have this sort of deep affection for the place, it's palpable. And Heartland is such an amazing place. There's something like 5,000 degree-seeking students there at any one time. We'd really love to work out a way where we can stitch some of those students into the fabric of our place in a way that is consistent with what we want to do, that also benefits some local students in that way. So there are lots of ways to increase our enrollment. I was just at a function in Kenwood at alumni two alumni couple's house. They have a friend who's the director of the Obama Library Project in the South Side. And so we had an event for prospective students and their parents and for alums to come and listen to him give a brief presentation and sort of talk. And we're gonna get 3-4 students from that we probably expose to something they wouldn't have seen otherwise. And I think it's a baseball cliche, small ball. You know, you get somebody on first and you get them around. It's 3 students here and 4 students there and 6 students there. We're small, and we have an incoming class that's, you know, in the neighborhood of 500. And so influencing the class up and down a little bit in that way is what we need to do. So I think the key is a careful, reasoned approach, and we don't need to resort to anything drastic in response to short-run fluctuations. We have a supportive board of trustees. We have a substantial endowment. And we're in the place that we need to be. We just have to have a little bit of focus on what the next 2 or 3 or 4 years of recruiting looks like.
So you're going to stay the course regarding staff and infrastructure and eat the loss that those 200 to 300 kids who aren't coming temporarily produce.
Yeah, short run staffing changes, ups and downs as a result of changes in enrollments in particular classes or something. That's normal. So there'll be some change in terms of there always is in any given year. But I think we shouldn't construe sort of short run responses to in terms of, you know, visiting positions hired or something like that to strategic responses.
If you do have staff adjustments, it would be attrition and not through riffing.
That's the plan, yeah.
Illinois Wesleyan University President Eric Jensen speaking with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Axline Pharmacy, an independent, locally owned pharmacy committed to the Bloomington Normal community. Axline's community give back program allows patients to earn a donation to GLT with each prescription filled. Information at Axline Pharmacy in Towanda Plaza. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up during Sound Ideas, it's a conversation with a Democratic candidate for Illinois' 13th Congressional District, IPR's Brian Moline, talks with former Durbin fundraiser Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. That interview is ahead during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. 1 year after Donald Trump's election, journalists are still trying to find their way with how to cover such an unconventional president. To find out what voters think of Trump, NPR's national political correspondent Don Gagne likes to use the oldest trick in the book, a conversation at their kitchen table. Gagne was the featured speaker Friday at GLT's Radio Faces. He told GLT's Ryan Denham that he spends 100 nights a year on the road, and he's learned a lot in the past year.
You have to talk to people. You really have to talk to people, and there is no substitute for that. It's funny. Every place I go, I drop into towns. As long as I've been doing this, I still drop into towns I have never been there before. And you're always on deadline as soon as you get there. You're just on deadline. So maybe it's a leisurely deadline, and if it's Monday, I don't have to file until Wednesday afternoon or something. But between that moment and the deadline, you have to get everything you need for a story that somehow captures this place. So I've learned that every place has its treasures. Every place has things that they're proud of. And if you find out what they are and go see them, you bump into people who tell you about other people, who tell you where you should eat lunch. And when you're at the diner, there are people to talk to, and then you can maybe convince people to, geez, how about if I stop over your house tonight, you know? So you're always kind of getting to know the place and getting to know the people, and it's not easy. It's just doing the work and walking around and, you know, getting those little pieces one at a time. But if you do that, ultimately, you can write your story with a lot more confidence, and you feel like you've been there, which is the other thing. You don't want to wake up and go, where am I? What is this place? If I've done that kind of groundwork while I'm there, I always know where I am, and I actually think that's pretty important.
What are some things that you have done to kind of put this presidency into context? I think that it's sort of, at times, it seems like it kind of begs us for hyperbole, right? Or this is the most unprecedented thing since blank, or this has never been done before, things like that. What are some things that you do to try to ground your reporting and keep it in context?
You know, and sometimes the hyperbole is what you use, because it's accurate, and then it's exceeded or surpassed by something that happens next week. The pace of news and the pace of unusual things that we've just never seen a president or a White House do before is pretty relentless. It just is. And sometimes it's big stuff. Sometimes it's his Twitter feed. Sometimes it's, it's how he insults people in his own party or attacks his predecessors in ways that presidents don't usually do that. I think the key is that you don't just put all that aside and say, "Oh, that's just the way it is now. We're not going to worry about that." That is a big part of the story, and you have to cover that. You have to cover the tweets, for example, and everything else. But you also cover it in the context of how it's playing out in the world, and how it's playing in the legislature and what results it is ultimately leading to. So as long as you have these standards to measure it by, it's okay to call it unprecedented. It's okay to call it something we've never seen before, never heard before. But you always kind of want to make sure that your coverage broadly provides that context. And the thing we didn't really talk about is we're doing it while we're being attacked as reporters. And I mean, we could talk about that at great length, but basically what I say is, you know, it's like you can't take the bait, you can't take it personal, and you just got a job to do. You just have a job to do, and you make sure you got your facts straight, and you make sure your story's buttoned down, so if somebody comes at you because of your story, you're able to defend it.
Have you noticed any change in the way that people react to you when you come up to them and say you're a member of the media or with NPR as you've gone out and talked to people?
It might be a little bit more hostile in some Republican circles, among those hardcore Trump supporters. But I always find that if I work it, I can find people who are going to be happy to talk to me, happy to let me to come into their home, and happy to explain to me why they think the way they think about him or this issue or that issue. But you go to a Trump rally, and the onslaught against reporters is, like nothing I've ever seen before. There we go, more hyperbole, right? People complaining about us and saying nasty things about us is certainly nothing new, and I've been at this a long time. So I've heard plenty of groups vilify us even before this president came along. So.
What is your take on what we saw a few days ago in Virginia, New Jersey, and the election on November 7th? What are some things that you saw there that are maybe noteworthy moving forward?
Well, it was a great day for Democrats. There's no two ways about it. And, yes, it was New Jersey, a traditionally blue state, and Chris Christie, the governor there, is immensely unpopular. So no shock the Democrat won there. Virginia, yes, it's been trending blue. Hillary Clinton carried the state, but Republicans really felt they had a shot, and they had a well-funded candidate who had taken a lot of plays out of the Trump playbook. And not only did he lose, it was a much bigger Democratic win than anybody was ready to predict or even imagine. Then you look at the Virginia State House, which went from being overwhelmingly Republican, and now a handful of recounts over the next couple of weeks will determine who has control. And it could be the Democrats. It could be the Democrats. So it was an important day for Democrats, and it at least signals that like Democrats have had trouble in the past and in the last election, Trump can have trouble holding his, group or coalition or voters together. And it felt like that for the first year of his presidency and since the last election, that all of the usual rules didn't apply because of the way he won and the things he was able to say and do and still win. And suddenly it felt like some of the traditional ways of winning campaigns kind of reasserted themselves. Now, how long will it last? What does it mean? I'm not going to make any prediction, but it's at least a really good sign for Democrats going into 2018.
Well, tonight is obviously about public radio to a large degree. I want to ask you one question about your time at NPR. I learned today that you started your career at Detroit Public Radio,
yes,
reporting on labor unions, automakers, and all that. Can you talk about your time at NPR and why it's been such a good fit for you, your personality, the things you're curious about, the way you operate? You've stayed there for so long and had such success.
It really has become home. And I was a hardcore NPR listener before I ever worked for NPR. I did a stint in commercial radio, and I listened to tapes of NPR that I made to kind of learn how to be a journalist and how to craft a story and all that. And I'd been listening, years before that when I was in college. So it was the place I always wanted to work. I just didn't know I'd get a chance to work there. And, once I got there, I didn't know how long I'd be in the business. And I have now worked for public radio more than 30 years, which is kind of mind-boggling to me, certainly, and maybe to others as well. And it has just always been a place that has let me grow, that has let me tell stories in a, in a non-sensational, thoughtful, in a way that you don't get in other, broadcast medium. And it's just been a very satisfying and a very rewarding place. And NPR was a lot smaller when I started. So as I've grown up, it's grown as well. So it's always been a place where I've found new challenges and new adventures. And what more can you ask for?
NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne speaking with GLT's Ryan Denham Friday during GLT's Radio Faces event at the DoubleTree in Bloomington. See photos from the event at our website, WGLT.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Four Democrats are seeking their party's nomination for the 13th District Congressional seat currently held by Republican Rodney Davis of Taylorville. This congressional race is Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan's first attempt to win public office. She's a development officer with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield. She's picked up two endorsements in the last week, the first from the Political Action Committee Emily's List, which seeks to elect female Democratic pro-choice candidates, and the second from U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, for whom Londrigan worked as a fundraiser from 2007 to 2009. IPR's Brian Moline spoke with Londrigan about the 13th District race and why she decided to enter.
Well, you know, my tipping point was the day that I saw Rodney Davis celebrating on the White House lawn with Donald Trump and all of their cronies after passing the Trump Care bill in May. It just showed such disconnect to what people's lives are and what and how a medical emergency can devastate their lives. You know, my husband and I have three kids, and we almost lost our oldest son, Jack, 8 years ago to a, you know, random tick bite. And that ended our family in the pediatric intensive care unit for 21 days. I mean, it was terrifying. He was read last rites twice. And, you know, coming out of that experience and being able to take Jack home to begin a long recovery made some things very, very clear. Number one, if we didn't have good access to medical care, we would have lost our son. And if we didn't have good insurance, we would have gone bankrupt in 2009. And if they hadn't lifted the caps, we would be financially ruined now. And so that's real-life experience, and this is what families across our district and across our nation face, and it just shows a disconnect to what working families go through on a regular basis, particularly with a medical emergency. And in our district, you know, it would have cost jobs. I mean, we have a lot of jobs tied up in the healthcare industry in the 13th. Our rural hospitals would have closed. And to me, that is inexcusable to go to Washington and push for a bill that would devastate your district and then go out and celebrate. No excuse for it.
Betsy, as you look at current healthcare law in the United States, do you think the ACA can be improved upon? And if so, how would you go about doing that?
Well, you know, it's a step. And that's, I think, the way that we need to look at the ACA is a step. And right now, it is, you know, we need to triage the ACA, just fix it to the point where people aren't going to lose the protections and the insurance that they have. And then let's come together and look at how we move forward. There are a few things that we can do as a nation right now to help bring down our health care costs, such as make sure that we unleash the power of Medicare to negotiate for drug prices. You know, we can do that. And as far as what healthcare is going to look like, there are some great options out there. You know, right now, Senator Schatz from Hawaii has a great option out there. Chairman Lujan has always been a fan of a public option. Senator Kaine has some public option ideas. And, you know, I think we need to see what the see what's out there and decide which is the best way to move forward. The ACA is a step on the path to making sure that every person has access to health care. And as long as we all believe that health care is a right and not a privilege, then we can take another step on the journey.
Any thoughts on a single-payer system, whether that be in the medium term or in the long term?
I think that might be something to look at down the road. What I want to do right now, though, is make sure that people have maintain the protections and the insurance and the affordability of what they can have right now. And we do need to fix the ACA. It doesn't work for everybody. So let's fix it, look at it as a first step, and let's move forward together.
We're talking just a little over 24 hours after the horrific shooting at a church in South Texas where more than 20 people lost their lives. Betsy, your thoughts on that situation in Texas and what we might be able to do, whether it's in terms of gun control legislation for mental health, whatever it might be, to help prevent situations like this from happening in the future?
Well, it's another sad situation, and it's happening all too often in our nation. And, you know, one thing I think that that gun owners and non-gun owners can agree on is that we need universal background checks. And we need to know who has guns. And I think that's pretty good common sense agreed upon legislation. And, you know, right now we've got a congressman who's co-sponsoring House Bill, I think it's House Bill 38 about concealed carry reciprocity. And what that's going to do is that is going to bring Illinois down to the lowest common denominator for concealed carry. So, you know, Illinois has decided that we don't want guns in school zones. And if this bill is passed, then that means that Illinois, even though we have spoken out and been firm in what we stand for, we lose that privilege, and we lose the ability to monitor our own schools, because this bill will say, well, you know, we're gonna if somebody has concealed carry in another state, then whatever their state is, they can have those same rules in Illinois. So it lowers bar way too low.
One of the things being debated in Congress this week is new tax legislation that, among other things, would cut the corporate tax rate from 35% down to 20%. It would reduce the number of tax brackets and also eliminate some tax deductions from the system. What are your thoughts on the legislation being discussed this week? And assuming that you're not in favor of it as it stands right now, what are some ways that you would like to see the tax code reformed?
Well, you know, right now, with the tax reform that the bill that we're looking at, it's horrible for middle class working families. It's terrible for Illinois. I mean, Illinois, it's a double whammy when we lose the ability to write up the state and local taxes. And, you know, what really gets me is that the write-offs that they are taking away, they're going after students who have taken out loans to go to school and have the ability right now to write off some of the interest on their student loans. Those are going away. So they're going after students. And, you know, and medical expenses. The people who are using the write-off for medical expenses are people who have somebody in their family or themselves who are chronically ill. And so a huge portion of their income has to go to simply pay for their medicine, their ongoing hospitalization, or their care at home. And now they're going to lose that, too. And what are they supposed to do?
Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, one of four Democrats seeking her party's nomination in the 13th Congressional District. She spoke with IPR's Brian Moline. The other Democrats in the race are U of I Professor Jonathan Ebel, Dr. David Gill of Bloomington, and attorney Eric Jones of Edwardsville. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Wherever the day's biggest story is unfolding, Morning Edition will connect you to the voices at the center of it all.
Police say a man in a rented Home Depot truck
page
drove...
indictment alleges that Manafort and Gates used...
This comes after the Catalan parliament declared independence.
Whether the news is happening close to home or whether it hits close to home, start your day with Morning Edition tomorrow.
Hear Morning Edition Monday through Friday, now starting at 4 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, proud to serve you from his new office in historic downtown Bloomington. Justin offers life insurance options to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
I'm Mike McCurdy. Students at Illinois State University are learning how to give back to those who serve our country while engaging with the local community. Laura Kennedy has more in this edition of the GLT Datebook.
Operation Santa is on the march, sewing, stuffing, packing, and shipping stockings to members of the United States military who are serving overseas. The Operation Santa campaign is in full swing at Illinois State University and is administered by Fell Hall Call to Action, which is an initiative within the School of Communication. The students are encouraged to participate in Operation Santa as community service. Patty Franz is the administrative clerk for the School of Communication, and she's managed Operation Santa for 9 years, along with assistance from graduate students, including Haley Palmer, who says this year there's one item in particular that is most wanted in the stockings.
We've had a big push right now for black socks. We like to include a warm, dry pair of socks with every stocking.
You cannot underestimate the value of a good pair of socks.
Exactly, exactly. We also try to put a toothbrush and toothpaste in most of the stockings because a fresh toothbrush is a nice thing to have. Hard candies. We've gotten a request for hot sauce if we can.
Hot sauce?
Yeah. We hear that they really like the individually wrapped hot sauce packet.
What else?
Playing cards have been a big donation this year. What else have we gotten? Rice Krispie treats, granola bars, just treats that kind of remind them of home.
You are a graduate student here at Illinois State University. Why get involved in Operation Santa and help out? Why is that important to you?
Firstly, it's because of Patty. Patty kind of runs the School of Communication grad students. Well, she does. Patty really kind of inspires the students and helps them, and she always goes above and beyond, and you can really see that with the way she works with Operation Santa. And so when she was looking for interns, I, of course, put my name in the ring, because who doesn't want to be part of something that helps someone else?
I understand that this year you're teaming with the Illinois State University Department of Family and Consumer Sciences. Why is that this year?
Oh, yes. So I reached out to the president, Allison O'Brien, of the Fashion Design and Merchandising Association.
Uh-huh.
They sewed stockings for us because all of the stockings we send are handmade. And I saw a sign for a Fix It Friday that they held. And I was like, wow, if they're doing that for students on campus, I'm sure they would love to help us. And so I reached out to Allison, and they were all for it. They actually held an event on the 24th of October, and they all got together, and they sewed stockings for us.
Patty, you're sending items overseas to soldiers, but what about the canines who were serving with those soldiers? Are you sending anything, any like cute little stockings for the canine units?
Yes, as a matter of fact, just last week I picked up doggy stockings that were homemade by a woman in Goodfield, and she gave us doggy bones, and she gave us tennis balls and different items to fill the stockings with.
And the local Petco also donated hundreds of tennis balls to Operation Santa this year, and so we were very grateful for them.
And it's not just items that you're looking for. It costs to send these things overseas. Donations are helpful too, I presume?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And if we have money left over, then we'll buy enough crew socks for everyone.
More, you know, socks.
Yes.
Socks for everybody.
And we're hoping for packets of taco sauce.
I love the idea of putting socks into stockings, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Patty, over the years, have you had any feedback from some of the soldiers who've received items from Operation Santa?
Yes, we have some pictures and some thank you on our Operation Santa website. It's operationsanta.us.
This year, we've had a lot of support from local high schools. We have had two students from Normal Community who are currently still students reach out, and they set up two different football games, and they're collecting donations within the school. We've also had football games with Normal West, University High School, and Bloomington High School. And it's just really cool to see all the high schoolers getting involved.
And we have another woman on the board that has been going to the elementary schools, and oh my, you should see all the items they've sent us. Rainbow Girls, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, they're all involved.
That's Patty Franz and Haley Palmer, part of Operation Santa. You can find more information on the datebook page at WGLT.org. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Operation Santa not only takes a great deal of organization, but time as well. The team begins work months before the holidays are even on the horizon. And as soon as one year's operation has wrapped up, they begin work on the next. GLT is a unit within the School of Communication. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website, WGLT.org, is where you can find individual stories and interviews heard on Sound Ideas, or look for the full episode podcast with help today from Laura Kennedy, Ryan Denham, and Charlie Schlinker. Share your thoughts about the show at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Email us at news@WGLT.org or tweet, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. We'll be right back.